countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Now with our highest ever readership of 321,000 weekly readers.
Now on RTE Radio 1, it's over to Ella McSweeney for this week's Countrywide.
Good morning and welcome.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Now with our highest ever readership of 321,000 weekly readers.
Coming up for you this morning, in search of our largest wader bird, the curlew, in Galway. Reversing water pollution in Loch Ennell and restoring farm buildings using traditional skills. And it's lovely to be with you this morning. It's a beautiful morning out there. Well, we begin with the sound of life on the land, on a beef and sheep farm. May is, of course, arguably the best month of the year to see and hear nature. And this is particularly true on Nicholas Redmond's 50-acre farm in Ballygarrett, County Wexford.
We're in your yard. I can see there in the distance, just to the left, your sheep. What breed are they?
They're a mixed breed. Originally, they would have been Jacob, but they've been gradually crossed with Galway and then with Romney.
Is a swallow there?
Yeah, swallows. I don't know. Have anyone noticed? Now, I didn't hear anything about it. Swallows have collapsed in the last few years. Here, anyway. We used to have maybe 12 pairs, and we were down to three.
Nicholas, we've just come out of your yard and we're coming down what feels like a very narrow secret path surrounded by a whole variety of ferns, emerging foxgloves there. A just gorgeous little secret, feels like a sort of secret path.
We call it the jungle.
Oh, the jungle. Yeah, it feels a bit like a jungle. So we've just entered a bit of an orchard, is it?
This is planted maybe 30 years ago.
30, and what kind of apples did you plant?
Old varieties mostly. Well, my favourite is the Ashmead's Kernel. It's a really good cropper and very reliable. The donkeys are really clipped. They'll clip everything down to the ground. They eat everything.
No.
And they're extremely good then on the flower meadows after grazing.
In what way?
Their bite. They don't rip stuff out. Then they trample down the seeds back in. You know?
The boots are not, sorry.
Thank you. Go through the gate here, into the long grass. So we're going to step over the stream. Where does this stream link up?
Goes down to the bogs. Sand dune landscape, and then there's a water on the inside of that. Like a kind of a slob. On our farm, it's all wooded. All that's planted now. On this farm, there was no trees when I came here.
So you line the stream with trees?
Yeah. We even had otters up here. They come up sometimes. We're now in the far field. Here is the herd of Dexters.
And they're trotting down to see us. Look at them.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and we have a calf, a new calf. Yeah.
From last night?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, little black one.
Tiny, isn't it?
Tiny, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they're like little dogs.
It is. They're amazing, actually, calves. They have a very, they're very instinctual. So normally the calf will be hidden in the hedge all day, like a deer.
I presume the mothers still think there are wolves in Ireland.
The dogs might be an issue, so.
When did you start to keep Dexter cattle?
6 or 7 years now, maybe.
What happened to your land when Dexters started to graze the grass?
There's a lot more mushrooms, fungi.
And why do you think that is?
It's to do with the way the cows digest food, I'm sure.
For you as a farmer, why is it good to have fungi?
Fungi are a sign of soil health. Fungi are essential in nature. Fungi recycle all the nutrients. Decompose dead plants, turn it back into nutrients and then provide that then for the new plants or the existing plants. So sign of a very good soil health is a diverse fungal flora, if I want to use it that.
Let's walk up to your hedgerow here. It's a big, thick, diverse hedgerow on the side of the stream. It's like a little choir coming from it. Mm-hmm. What do we got here?
Edibles.
Got golf balls on the grass.
No, this is edible mushrooms.
Oh, nice.
That's what I'm saying. You see, we're getting lots of different types of fungi.
They're bright white, aren't they?
Field mushroom.
So for you, when you see that, you just think good soil.
Good soil and something to eat. When I came here, this was completely empty. There was no trees whatsoever, bar, you know, some hedgerow trees. There's a couple of nice ash. And then I methodically set about planting.
And it must be quite something to see an oak woodland over time as it grows.
Absolutely. Just for anyone that wants to do it, it's really worthwhile because you will see it in your lifetime, easily.
So we've come into the wood.
Main species, oak. Now I'll show you one of our most special items in the wood, which is our buzzard nest. There she is. They were in it 2 years and they've hatched.
Big, isn't it?
It's big.
So it's high up in... Now, that's not an oak, is it?
No, that's a Scots pine.
A Scots pine. It's completely hidden by oak.
Mm.
And when did you spot that?
The first hatching they had in it was the year before last year.
Mm.
And they reared one, which fledged successfully. So it was great. I mean, that must be the first time ever, probably.
And so they're only here because there's food on your farm, aren't they?
Yeah, and habitat for them to nest in, yeah. Last year we also had the first nesting long-ear owls and they hatched successfully.
Wow.
And every year we have sparrowhawks. Blackbirds are the main dawn chorus guys, of course. We would have thrushes, wrens, various tits of all types and scripts, and we have a lot of chaffinches here. We have some woodpeckers, but they're not around all the time. Cuckoo we had this year, yeah. First time in 10 years. And it's lovely.
Nicholas, what's your approach to farming? Like, how do you see your role as a farmer?
I'm looking after nature, really. That's my thing. Yeah. I mean, one has to exist, but I'm not driven by commercial concerns. My joy, I would say, is to create something and maintain it, something better than it was here before, to enhance the nature, yeah. Because it's beautiful. What way do you want to have your life? Do you want your life surrounded by nature, by beautiful birds and insects and flowers? Or do you want to do it another way, yeah? That's a choice people have to make, yeah.
Nicholas Redmond on his farm in Wexford. And you know, there was so much to see on his farm. He also showed me his species-rich meadows, which will soon be absolutely alive with butterflies and bees. And he actually saves and sells the wildflower seeds, and then he makes hay for his cattle from that meadow as well. So it's a very interesting farm. And he is part of the Farming for Nature network. He's actually a Farming for Nature ambassador. And along with 35 other farmers, he'll be hosting a farm walk this summer, and it's open to the public. So for more information, go to farmingfornature.ie. Well, I was very sorry to hear of the death earlier this month of Eamon Madden. He was a fifth generation blacksmith and ironworker from Athenry who ran Madden's Forge for over 60 years. And a few years ago, I had the huge privilege of meeting Eamon in his forge. And he was a strong, wide-shouldered gentleman with huge shovels for hands, and he particularly loved working with and talking about horses. Here he is talking to me in his forge about them.
Harshoon was the big thing. Every creature around, they had a bit of land and they'd have the horse. It was a way of life for generations, that way. You could talk to the poor horse. Somebody'd hold him by the head hold them by the bridle, and you do your job, put on the shoes and that you can hear the noise of the anvil. Preparing farm implements, ploughs and the grills that keep the cattle in. They would be made by somebody that'd be doing iron work. You know. You'd be sorry, you'd leave you with memories, you know. Leave you with lovely memories. But that's life.
Eamon Madden, who passed away aged 98, a skilled craftsman and a real artist, and my sincere condolences to his family. Well, luckily, Eamon's legacy can still be seen in the gates that he made, and they still hang on the fields of Athenry. This physical embodiment of his knowledge and skill is part of what makes skilled craftspeople, be they blacksmiths, stonemasons, weavers, tinsmiths, coppice caretakers, lime workers, it's so, so impressive. But there is a critical shortage of them in Ireland, just at a time when the demand is increasing for restorations and renovations. And also the idea of recycling material now makes real economic sense. Well, part-time farmer Tom Pollard is a stonemason and skills trainer in traditional stone walling. And he joins us this morning from Waterford. And Virginia Tian is the head of the Heritage Council, and she joins us from Cork. Good morning, Tom and Virginia.
Good morning, Ella.
Tom, morning. I just want to start with you. I suppose, is it fair to say that we're, what, two or three generations ago, you know, away where everyone would have lived in a house made from stone, mud, lime, straw and timber, and a house that would have been made essentially by hand?
Yeah, very much so. Good morning, Ella. Good morning, Virginia. Yeah, I think you're very right there. Like, say, two generations ago, you know, the vernacular was, you know, much more on our landscape, and a lot still remains. But even our Georgian streetscapes, yeah, an awful lot of traditional materials in them also. So, yeah, definitely. A lot of these materials, they're still standing. They're still good. They're recyclable and they're there to be used. Yeah.
And as I said, I mean, it does now, because of the cost of everything, make economic sense, doesn't it, to start looking at these, either restoring the buildings or recycling the materials that are there?
Oh, very much so. There's huge savings to be made. And there's so many other wins to that, like just the lack of transport required to just salvage, or the lack of transport required not to have to manufacture by just using local as well.
I was on a farm a few months ago, and the farmer showed me an old building in his yard. I mean, it was a beautiful, beautiful structure, but run down. It was sort of being eaten by ivy, a kind of forgotten building that had lost its purpose. It has had obviously huge potential. Hard to know where to start with it. He certainly wasn't sure whether to restore it, ignore it, knock it down. I mean, it feels very understandable. I just wonder, Tom, what's the argument to encourage farmers like that to restore and pay attention to these old buildings?
The encouragement, it's so easy to give, actually. If I had to stand there with you and that gent, I'd have definitely tried my very best to turn him around. By first things first, try and clean up the mess you're looking at. Carefully, you know, curb the ivy, cut it at the butt. You don't have to pull it out of the walls. That's probably a bad idea because it can bring material with it. So vegetation and the roof structure. Vegetation is trouble, so look after that. And the roof structure, if it's totally and utterly wobbly, it's dangerous. But if it's got some cover and it's sheltering the wall tops and the interior, that roof is doing its job still. So it's looking at the positives. And apart from the positives of how can we fix this building or what has this building got to offer, it's the uses you can gain from it. Again, I benefited from being a grantee of the Traditional Farm Building Scheme back in 2016. A very small shed that we fixed up. I won't go into too much detail, but now we use it for lambing. So in the colder months, we can have three O's in there and looking after the lambs. And then after I've cut my timber, which, you know, we have plenty of hedgerow, I coppice every year, I bring my timber in there and it's south facing. So the breeze comes in, dries my timber out. So it's for lambing and timber. And that could be the same for so many other sheds. Basic ideas, really.
Virginia, you run, the Heritage Council runs and manages the GLOS scheme on behalf of the Department of Agriculture, where you give grants to farmers to restore the buildings. Why do you think it's important?
Well, it's a very important scheme for us, and I think it's particularly important for the farming community. The farmers They manage and own a lot of our traditional vernacular architecture, and for many farmers it can be a problem keeping those buildings in good condition and maintaining them. The farmers want to keep them, and we want to work with them to support them in achieving that in the way Tom outlined there.
And what's your vision for the potential uses of these buildings? I mean, I have also been on farms where the farmers have done amazing restoration works, and they become, I don't know, Airbnb, sources of income, I suppose, important sources of income.
Well, I think as Tom has outlined, these buildings are very sturdy buildings that are sustainable, and farmers can use them for whatever purpose that's suitable for them. I mean, it can be for continuing to work on the farm, for storage, for animals, but equally they have commercial potential because these are unique buildings. They're very beautiful and they're part of our landscape and our history, and that uniqueness is what makes them attractive to visitors, and not only foreign visitors but to Irish visitors who wish to experience rural life and get a sense of the rural landscape and its beauty.
Tom, I suppose the biggest challenge is the fact that there's such a skills shortage. You know, I mean, it's not easy to do what you do, be a stonemason. It takes a long time to train. Just how bad is it?
I won't say that. I'll start with this, sorry. There's some excellent work being done around the country in every county, and there's an awful lot of really, really good skilled people working in our fields. But the problem is we're aging. It's a conversation so many of us trades, craft, skills people have is where's, you know, the help? Like personally, I'm 54. At the moment, I have an apprentice. He's over from France. He's 22. He's in his fifth year of his apprenticeship, and he's an excellent help. Very well-rounded guy, extremely talented already. I'm learning from him even. And, you know, he is the next generation in France. I can't find 22-year-olds too easily. Nobody I know can. And it's not done to have to be 22 years of age either, mind you. Any age would be great help. But the problem is, I think we've lost the focus on maybe the benefit of a job within the skills and the trades. And everyone I know, this is a true fact, is we all have a job for life. And a job for life is, that's a real accolade. And that's what we need to try and instill in people maybe is there, you know, a chance that I could get a meaningful career out of this that will last my working life? So at the moment, we're really missing out on attracting new hands. The hands that are working are great, they're happy, but we're seeing the problem now rather than having to live it drastically in maybe 10 years' time.
I suppose there's two things, isn't there? One, is there enough work out there? And two, how do you train? I mean, if you're a young person who's, you know, got an interest in whatever, being a blacksmith or a stonemason, you know, where do you go?
Very good question. First of all, there is plenty of work to answer your first question. My work this year will have me visit 6 different counties in Ireland and 2 in particular in Waterford. So we'll call that 7 jobs in 6 counties and work we've also refused. To learn, that's a very good question also. You can do a couple of courses, say, with the ETBs, like the traditional stonewall construction skills course, very long-winded, but it's a good course, but it's really just a grounding course. It's after that course, normally you help the students get a 3-week placement. If they're lucky, maybe whoever gave them the placement will, you know, retain that pair of hands, that person, that individual, and keep the spark alive. But at the moment, we don't have a huge amount of dedicated training. And I know it's been discussed within government, and I know there's many other players in the game, like the Prince's Foundation have advertised 6 places this year. We have people like SPAB, the Society for the Protection of Ancient Buildings, the BLFI, they work in highlighting the benefits of working with lime mortars. They run workshops. But unfortunately, these workshops, as good as they are, there's very little kind of immersive, in-depth follow-up training one can take, unless you might meet someone, say, like myself, perhaps, who's got an opening and sees the potential and says, right, I'm going to invest in you if you invest your time with me. And that's all we're looking for. We're not looking to, you know, any of us are. We're not looking to kind of, I suppose, try and use this person. We're trying to nurture and find maybe the right person to be with your team in the future.
And I presume you would encourage educators, you know, to encourage young people, both
boys and girls to look at traditional skills as a potential profession?
Very much so, yeah. I think our educators know it, and I think maybe it's a very difficult one to quantify and to decide, let's try and form a syllabus around all these. But they need to, unfortunately, look aside and think, right, can we just put some time aside and work on this and maybe just focus on what skills are really lacking in terms of numbers and the work potential. There's some amazing schemes unraveling at the moment. Like, for example, I think, is it, you know, they say was there's 30 million made available. Just, I only heard about this yesterday, for local authorities, whereby derelict buildings can be bought for up to €400,000. So buildings in the public domain, convents, banks, post offices, cinemas, and they want them to become community centres on digital hubs to help people who avoid the commute to work. This is an amazing initiative. There's 30 million going into it. My fear, and many of us, our fear is who's going to carry out this work to the standard needed? Because when you mention convents, banks, post offices and cinemas, they're our built heritage. They have to be carefully renovated and brought into the future, which is we're very welcoming of.
And Virginia, just finally, I mean, we know, briefly, we know that the grants are there for the farmers. If I was lucky enough to own land, I'm not a farmer. Are there grants available to just landowners to restore old buildings?
No, I'm afraid not. Not from the Heritage Council. And just to agree with Tom there around the traditional skills, it's a really key skill that's required and necessary. And the Heritage Council are working with the Prince's Foundation to fund 6 bursaries this year to support the sector. But it's a really area of great commercial and heritage potential, and one that we really wish to support and enhance and increase the number of grants and indeed increase the GLOSS scheme to those farmers beyond the GLOSS programme.
Super. Well, listen, if you want more information, go to heritagecouncil.ie. And I know, Tom, you've set up Irish Traditional Skills Initiative. That's itsi-ireland.com, which is urging people to do what you've spoken about, which is to look at traditional skills as a potential future. Tom Pollard and Virginia Tehan, thank you both very much for joining us this morning. We'll take a break.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Get Irish Country Living, your magazine for rural Ireland, every week inside the Irish Farmers Journal.
Welcome back. Ella McSweeney with you here this morning. Well, it is hard to get your head around the staggering disappearance of curlews in Ireland. In just 30 years, their population has dropped by 98%. It is barely clinging on with less than 120 breeding pairs left. And one of the problems, I suppose, for the curlew is the fact that it nests on the ground in grasses during May and June, on the very same grasses that farmers cut for silage. Well, the National Parks and Wildlife Service are working with farmers to increase the curlew's chance of survival. They're even attaching GPS trackers to the birds so they know where they are and how to mind them and look after them. Hannah Quinn Mulligan went to Galway to find out more.
So the team is here and everyone has their binoculars, so you can see him, can you?
Yeah, we can see him just above us here. And we'll likely hear a call or two in a moment as he comes to investigate.
Oh my God, I've never seen a live curlew before.
Fantastic. They're stunning birds.
So we're here today in the beautiful Slievochtes overlooking a lake, and the mist is rising. It's early morning and I cannot tell you exactly where we are, because we're here with the National Parks and Wildlife Service, and our aim today is to catch a male curlew and put a GPS tracker on it. And they're highly endangered birds, so their locations are top secret. And Sean Kelly is here with me, and also Alan Walsh as well. So Alan, you're actually going to trap the bird, is it?
We will hopefully be able to trap them. We'll judge the bird's behaviour and so on and see if that's conducive to us being able to put a net down and catch it. If he only kind of comes and gives a kind of courteous look, but he isn't really interested in defending the territory as a result of the call, then we might sort of step down on that. So it's very much in response to the bird's behaviour that we make a judgment call on that.
So how many pairs of curlew do we have left in Ireland?
We have less than 120 pairs at the moment, and that's probably kind of a, a 99% decline to say the early 80s as to how many pairs we used to have. So they really are kind of on the brink as such in Ireland.
Well, look, the team is gathering and we have a couple other members here, so I don't want to hold you up. So do you want to get your lure out and I'll follow on?
Great, great.
So Hubert Sauvignon, the head of the Curlew Conservation Programme here. We're walking down a path between all this bog and you're carrying plates for an explosive device that's going to launch a net that's going to catch this curlew. So it's going to happen today. Last year we tried to find a curlew, we found a hen harrier.
Yes, yeah.
How has the Curlew Pro programme been going since I saw you last year?
It's a lot of hard work, a lot of heartbreak as well, as the situation of the curlew is really difficult and complicated, but we've fantastic teams on the ground and everybody's working really hard. So this year we are quite happy to report that pretty much all of the curlew that we're expecting to see back at our 9 core areas are coming back. So it's there's hope yet. It's great news.
The bird won't be hurt. You're just blasting a net around it, essentially.
Just firing a net at over its head.
And so what's the next step now? What are you about to do? I see you have a dummy curlew that you're going to put there.
We have to use a dummy curlew, yes, exactly, with a bit of a playback call as well. And that sort of stimulates the male in the territory to get more aggressive to it and come down. And basically, he attacks it. And at that point, we fire the net over it because we know he's in exactly the position within the net area that we want him to be in, which is very safe. And that's when we hopefully will catch it.
The call has just gone out. So we've taken a step back and everyone has their binoculars. So Hubert, what's going on there? You can see better than I can.
The curlew is high up in the air, kind of above forestry, and I think he's checking the surrounding area to see where the sound is coming from.
Hubert, am I cursed?
Not at all. Not at all.
You'll never allow me out again.
No, probably not now, yeah.
We had two of them at one stage that were on either side of it, kind of looking, but they wouldn't come any closer.
Yeah, two birds calling, one either side, one in the distance and one close, but I think we're probably on the edge of the territory, it seems, by the behaviour of the birds. They're just not fully committed.
Yeah.
So
obviously we didn't manage to catch the curlew today, but we did see the curlew. And there are lots of conversations about, I know it's maybe a political point, about rewilding and things like that, but for the habitat that's in front of us, it does need some form of grazing management at certain points of year.
These areas, there's kind of some nice, I suppose, maybe low-intensity farming, and this is really good for wildlife. And we need to continue that farming at that intensity and kind of, I suppose, targeting the management.
You talked earlier about the curlew chick, and the curlew chick, its defensive mechanism is to hide and to crouch even lower, which isn't much good when the silage mower is coming along. But at the same time, the farmer wants to make silage in May because it's going to be better quality, and especially in a time like this where feed prices have gone through the roof, high quality forage is really, really important.
It absolutely, if we're asking farmers to make changes to their system and to, like I say, to not cut in May when it might get the best product, then we need to financially reward them to produce a different product as such, and that's a biodiversity product. So there should be a reward for that at that biodiversity market, so the farmer as such isn't at a loss at the end of the season.
I know you're heading on to Roscommon, to another top secret location, to try and track the curlew today. And I've got to go home to my own farm in Limerick. But will you keep us updated on what happens with you and the curlew and in terms of the breeding project and everything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we'll have our tagging programme finish up in the coming weeks and we can report back on how things have gone. And hopefully that GPS data has come in handy to locate nests and eventually ultimately produce more chicks.
Lovely sound there. Hannah Quinn Mulligan with Sean Kelly from the National Parks and Wildlife Service. And he gave us an update. And there are now trackers on 12 curlews. And he also told us that one of the birds they caught in Monaghan, they tracked it, that it flew to the Yorkshire Dales for a week before returning to the exact same spot in Monaghan 7 days later, which is remarkable. So good luck to Sean and his team there. Now, water pollution is fast becoming a real issue for the public. In a survey last December, November by the Environmental Protection Agency, 81% of people said they were most concerned about water pollution in their local area. Well, until this year, Loch Ennell in Westmeath was so badly polluted with harmful bacteria that the County Council told people not to swim in it. But Westmeath County Council have found a way to turn it around by working with farmers to clean up the water. And the good news is that the lake is now designated once again as a bathing area and people can safely go in and swim. So how was it done? Well, Jonathan Dean from Westmeath County Council is with me now. Good morning, Jonathan.
Thank you, Ella, and thanks for the invite.
Congratulations.
Well,
you must be delighted.
Well, we are. And it wasn't just Westmeath County Council. We were working with a lot of different people. We were working with the EPA, with Law Pro, with the farmers, with Chagask and the IFI, the fishermen and a lot of community groups down there. But we're all very pleased at the situation that we have now got to in Loch Ennell.
It's all about collaboration, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because we couldn't have done this on our own because it's such a complex issue. It's very difficult to understand what's going on in the lake, and we have to rely on the community because they know these things best. It's not just engineering and science. We just have to work with the community on these particular issues.
So take me back to 2018. I mean, just how bad was it in Loch Ennell?
Well, in 2018, from June, July, August, the readings went just right off the scale. Like, our highest reading was in August 2018, when it was up to 32,000 E. coli in 100 mil. And the actual threshold to go from good to poor is 90. So we were just numbers of orders of magnitude over the top. It was actually, it became a health issue.
And so at that stage, in terms of the Irish picture, Loch Ennell would be way down on the...
It was always way down, because the issue with Loch Ennell is because it's a surface water-based lake, in terms of that it's fed from rivers. We have two other pristine water bodies in Westmeath. We have Portnashangan and Loch Ool and Loch Lane, and both of those are spring-fed. So the water quality is usually better with spring-fed lakes, and they've always been pristine right through the whole... number of years. Loch Ennell is different. It's more susceptible to surface water-based pollution, and that's really what happened. And in 2018, it just went wrong.
And I mean, from your perspective, 2018, what were you thinking then?
Well,
were you thinking, this is a lost cause?
Well, we didn't consider the lost cause at that point. But we were going in a particular direction. We looked at a lot of septic tank analysis. Our scientists in Westmeath were working in an area and looking at the different domestic or there's different facilities on the perimeter of Westmeath. But the turning point was actually when we did some scientific testing and we were able to do PCR testing in UCD. Professor Vin Myers there was very helpful. He did a lot of testing for us, and we were able to define that 97% of the pollution had the ruminant fecal matter. So therefore, we were able to say it was bovine, it was cattle. It wasn't sheep, it wasn't horses, it was cattle. And so therefore, we were able to pinpoint what the situation was. And we knew it wasn't human waste.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's a good example of where science is actually able to be very, very clear to all of us, look, this is where it comes from. Yeah. We know it's urban wastewater. We know it's septic tanks. We know it is cattle.
Yeah, it was key, because up to then we were just trying to look at so many different areas. But once we had that actual scientific test, we knew where to look and we knew actually the approach to take. And at that stage, then we knew that a part of it was going to be outside of what Westmeath County Council could do. So we were able to actually identify that we needed a lot of assistance from the farming community.
And the farming community is very strong there. Just talk a little bit about the kind of farming around the lake.
Well, it's very fertile land, so these are top producing farms, there are a lot of really good quality and farmers. And we did find that the farmers certainly wanted to engage, and it was very refreshing. Like, we don't do the actual direct farmer engagement; we do our normal sort of farm surveys. But the actual to get the farmers inside, we had to rely on ASIP, who is sort of an ASIPAR, sort of an agricultural sustainability type advice. They're part of Chagask, and they were able to actually go and meet the farmers and actually get into the conversations with them.
And ASIP, the Agricultural Sustainability Support and Advisory Programme, it's co-funded by public money through the Department of Agriculture and Housing, and also co-funded by the dairy industry.
Yes.
These advisors go and give free, confidential advice to farmers. Confidential being the important thing here.
Absolutely, you know, and it's a local authority. If we go into farms, we actually have to look at sort of, we look from an enforcement point of view. We have a Water Pollution Act and all that, but that's not really the right approach. If you want to affect serious and positive change, you got to work with the farmers. So that's why the aspect is so important, and it's confidential. So they can be the confessional person to the farmer, and it can actually sort of work with them. They also work over a longer time frame. We actually have to, under the Water Pollution Act, we've got to sort of enforce these things over very quickly, but they can take a sort of a seasonal approach and they can work with farmers, and that has been the most effective part of the whole process.
So how did you do it? I mean, what did the farmers change?
Well, a number of things. They would, the ASIP advisors would go down and meet them and would sort of set up a plan to change various different things over a long period. They would look at things like the use of slurry systems, and to ensure that they use sort of the low emission slurry rather than the broadcast, which is a much more effective way of doing it. And it actually injects the slurry into the ground. Biggest part then it was to ensure that any watering points were actually cut off, and that they would work with them to actually fence off the streams to ensure that the cattle couldn't wander through the streams and do whatever, and also that they and to do that because we worked with them to supply solar power drinkers.
These are becoming very popular, aren't they?
Very popular and very effective, and which means that you can just completely sever the connection between cattle and the stream, because these can pump all year round, and they can pump the water to a distance away from the stream, and they can also run their electric fences or whatever. And they're very competitive priced, and we were able to help with the funding on that, and they've been actually quite important. Some have gone in, and there's more to go in over this coming summer. And there was a lot of other areas that we were able to work with farmers to ensure that any surface water coming off the roofs was diverted to streams and not into soil water tanks, because it doesn't matter how big your soil water tanks are, if the surface water is running into it, it'll overflow. It'll weaponize what's ever into it and turns harmless rainfall into a polluting material, and it just flows down and into the lakes.
And I suppose, you know, we have to remind ourselves, Loch Ennell has, as you say, a very strong farming community around it.
Yes.
But it's also got other uses. There's other economic, you know, businesses that are dependent on Loch Ennell. It's fishing. There's a lot of tourism that goes on there as well.
There is, yeah. There's a tourism. There's a high quality hotel. There's golf courses. There's bars. There's a lot of And as I say, it's a massive trout fishing lake, and there's a massive interest in that. And the fishermen have been very much our eyes and ears on the ground. They will tell us something that's happening, and also they've actually put their hand in the pocket and contributed to some of the improvements. There are tourism facilities down there, boat hire. There's a whole community of people, and it was difficult for 19 and 20 when on an annual basis the EPA would come out with their bathing water review report, and again Loch Ennell would be failed, and we would get a lot of complaints and say that why has this happened again. So yeah, look at it. It was an emotive subject, but it was also a subject that people really wanted to get engaged in, and that made it a lot easier for us.
And the farmers, did you find them all very receptive to the kind of advice they were given?
Well, we were sort of an arm's length from the conversations, but ASIP have informed us that it was 95-97% engagement, because I think, you know, farmers, they are the custodians of the land. They want to do the right thing, but they want to do the right thing if they can, and it's, you know what I mean, they have to. These are highly profitable enterprises there, and that's why it was so good that the ASIP could sort of talk in their language with them and do it over, have progressive improvements over a number of years.
So you then test again. When did the results come back?
Well, we've been testing continuously, and 18, 19, 20, we began to turn around, and 21, we had a full clear round. And that was the first year for a number of years that the bathing water has been excellent. So because it's sort of a bathing water classification is on a 4-year average, because you don't know when these sort of outbursts are going to happen. So the EPA now have allowed us to go back and reclassify the bathing water quality.
And just talk to us a bit about the EU bathing water status. I mean, I very much associate it with the coastal areas, but rivers can be assigned, lakes can be assigned too.
Yeah, I believe there's 9 inland water bodies in the country that are at bathing water designation. 3 of them are in Westmeath.
These are all lakes.
They're all lakes. Mm. And what it means that if they are designating bathing water, it means that they're tested once a fortnight. And all of the results are actually posted on beaches.ie, and also they should be on the site there.
Yeah, I mean, I go down to Loch Ennell, have done for quite a few years, to look at the murmurations in winter. Yeah. And I couldn't help but notice these big signs that said, yes, do not swim.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah, look, it was difficult. It was difficult for everyone there, and we're delighted that we've turned that corner.
And with the bathing water status designations, I mean, can the public nominate areas? So, for example, I'm thinking, if the public is swimming in a river nearby, can they ask the council, look, assign this, designate this area, and then the council will be testing?
Yeah, there's an obligation under the Bathing Water Act that all local authorities should publicly consult once a year, and it happens during the summer, and I'm sure a lot of public local authorities are currently have an open consultation process, and the idea is then after that, then we actually sort of the local authority sort of evaluated it. It's not just bathing water quality, there's a lot of water issues that had to be looked in terms of water safety, currents and access and the like. So then they're obliged then to come back within a time frame to come back and say, is it a yes or a no?
But you would welcome hearing from people in Westmeath.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. We do. Mm. You know what I mean? There's been a lot of active requests to find a safe bathing water location in the Shannon. And certainly we're certainly looking into that.
It's very, very good news. What learning is there for other councils, do you think, in this?
Well, I think I should also mention that the Law Pro have been very, very great assistance to us. Law Pro are the Local Authority Water Protection Office, and they sort of they do sort of community and technical engagement for local authorities, and they really are very helpful. And they should be the first port of call for local authorities and also for members of the public if they have water quality issues. And then we had to do the HSE, we're on board, EPA, and then the community.
So it's all about collaboration.
It has to be all together.
Well, many congratulations to all of you and the farmers as well for making this happen. And I suppose the message is Loch Ennell is open and ready for business now. And safely, if you want to swim, then you can enjoy it.
Thank you very much, Ella.
And just for people who want to check out the areas that are designated, you can go to beaches.ie. Jonathan Dean from Westmeath County Council, thank you very much. Well, that's it for this week. Damien will be back with you next week. The producer this morning was Martina McGlynn. The broadcasting coordinator was Brian Moss, and Liam Mullen was on sound. I hope you all have a fantastic weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Now with our highest ever readership of 321,000 weekly readers.